The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now, what we're dealing with today is idealism, and more particularly, the thought of Johann Gottlieb Fichte. And we spell that capital J-O-H-A-N-N, and Gottlieb is G-O-T-T-L-I-E-B, and Fichte is capital F-I-C-H-T-E, capital F-I-C-H-E-T. We usually just say Fichte. And his dates are 1762 to 1814, 1762 to 1814. Well, now, Hermann Dooyeweerd discovers here in Fichte's thought the definite turning point, a turning point from the primacy of the science ideal to the primacy of the ideal of personality in opposition to the science ideal. You'll remember that we have been talking about the ideal of science, or the science ideal. Let's just remind ourselves a moment what we mean by that. Namely, the thought that one comes to himself, one is truly human then, or comes to be truly human by way of well-founded knowledge, knowledge that is established on an adequate foundation. And we saw how this ideal was present in Descartes, and also we found this in subsequent thinkers, and how it then was challenged and really came into crisis in the thought of David Hume. Then we turned, of course, to a different theme, namely that of the ideal of personality, that the ideal of personality, which indeed gave birth to this science ideal, but where this ideal of personality set itself up then in opposition to the science ideal. And in that context, we looked at Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and we looked at Immanuel Kant. But now, we come past Kant. Last time we looked at some of the difficulties of Immanuel Kant's position, and how then there was a movement past Kant. We discussed that just at the close of our lecture last time. It has been said that to understand Kant is to go beyond him. And those then who learned from him, the idealists indeed, in trying to understand him, did find that they were going beyond him. Now, in a radical move, Fichte excised, or he cut out, the remnants of heteronomy, which he still found in Kant's philosophy. In dealing with the humanistic idea of freedom, we have been emphasizing, of course, the idea of autonomy, the twin ideas of human autonomy and freedom are very, very important to the humanistic idea of human freedom, human worth, human personality. But now, Fichte was of the opinion that this idea of autonomy had not been carried through consistently enough in the thought of Immanuel Kant. There was still remnants of an idea that man's life is dependent on something which stands outside of his self. And so instead of being an autonomy where the law comes from the self, the nomos comes from the autos, the law then, or the nomos, would come from something other, heteros. So there would be a heteronomy instead of autonomy. So he tried to cut out what remained of heteronomy in the position of Immanuel Kant. We mentioned several areas, as you'll remember, areas of criticism of Kant's position. For one thing, there was a criticism of Kant's formalism. Kant, as we said, thought in terms of the categorical imperative, that we are ourselves. One becomes free, he is autonomous, he is true personality when he is following the law then of the categorical imperative, the absolute thou shalt. And as we found, Kant thought that one was truly himself then when he took the law of his action, or the subjective rule of his action, and if he could make that into a universal rule. Now, however, as we pointed out last time, the objection came, look, all right, you then say you're going to follow this, so that's a subjective axiom, the subjective rule or the maxim of your action can become a general rule. That tells you something about your action, the formal characteristic about it, but it does not tell you what to do. It does not give you any material content. It only gives you the form, or it tells you something about the form of your action. Another thing that we pointed out is that there was a problem with Kant's idea of synthesis. They thought that Kant still remained with a scheme where there would be a superordinated rule to which then one's response would be by way of instances of this rule. And that then meant that somehow the rule of one's action stood outside of himself. Well, at any rate, and third thing was that Immanuel Kant still retained the idea of the thing in itself. That is, we in our understanding must depend on the material of our sense experience, the things that comes to us then from our experience of the phenomenal world, the world as we perceive it around us. Indeed, as we do that, this, as we said, is they're the forms of our sensibility. There's the forms of our empirical experience, and there are the forms of understanding. These two things are related. And so we're always going toward, we're always having to advance then in our understanding. We can never actually get to the goal of complete understanding. But nevertheless, Kant said, even though we're always on the way, nevertheless, there is this goal. This goal, or the thing in itself, is there, and it is then something which is always beyond our reach, but beckons us. He was criticized too, that here is something then which stands outside of the odyssey of the self in its self-realization. Is there not something then heteronomous about the idea of the thing in itself? Now Fichte steps in, and he attempts to go beyond Kant. He attempts to go beyond Immanuel Kant. And he seeks then to excise, he seeks to cut out the remnants of heteronomy which he still finds in Kant's philosophy. For one thing, he threw out, he jettisoned the idea of the thing in itself. He says there is no thing in itself. If we then regard things, if we know that there are things, these have their meaning only in relationship to the self, to the creative self, the creative ego. Even nature is taken up in spirit. At least Fichte tries this, to take up nature in spirit. And he interprets nature in this way, that the objects around us, that they all have their meaning in terms of the odyssey of spirit. We can put it this way, that spirit posits nature. According to Fichte, spirit posits nature as the terrain of its activity. If we're going to understand then our lives, we're going to understand the way we deal with things, these things have their meaning then in terms of human activity, the ongoing human activity. Now here, the freedom motive clearly gains the upper hand. Fichte attempts to make freedom, autonomous freedom. He tries to make the self, as a creative self, the root of the meaning of the entire cosmos. It's all concentrated in the self. The self becomes the root of the meaning of the entire cosmos. In fact, of course, spirit then becomes the root of the meaning even of nature. At least that was Fichte tried. And so Fichte, even more than Kant, emphasized the direction to the self. We have noted in Immanuel Kant that all along there is a reflection on the self. And we ask then, why is it, we referred to Kroner's interpretation of Kant, why is it then that, what is the hidden motor behind Kant's talk about the transcendental unity of our perception, that transcendental unity of all our experience to which Kant referred. He says the motor behind it is Kant's ethical view, his ethical philosophy, finally then his view of the self. If there is a reflection in Kant on the self, then constituting itself a self, that is even more clear in the position of Fichte. Fichte, more than Kant, attempted to orient his thinking to the self. But this then was not a self considered as a substance. The idea of substance is a continuing problem in philosophy. We've mentioned it all along. But Fichte says, this is not then understood as a substance, something which is there, as they would say then, as something as it were a thing out there. But it is the self as it is freely creating itself. The self is always creating itself. And we can also say then, as it freely creates the non-self as the terrain of its activity. The self, the ego, in its creative character, is supposed to be the root of all things. Everything gains its meaning, has its meaning, in terms of the activity of the self. Now, if we then think in these terms, we have then to think that Fichte does not want to regard the activity of the self within the pattern of nature as established by Kant. You'll remember that we put it this way. If you have in a picture form an S and then a dash and then an O, And then you go up on the S, just to the right of the S, on the top of it, and draw a oblong, a kind of circle around underneath the O, and pointing back then to the S, and put a little arrow on the end of it. We saw that the pattern of nature was this, that I as a subject then have a particular object for a certain purpose. And that is the pattern of nature as it was described by Immanuel Kant, the pattern then that has continued on. It has the influence of this idea of nature has been quite pervasive, and you find it. Well, I do teach in contemporary theology, and I find this view of nature again and again and again in contemporary theologians. Well, the activity of the eye will not fit within that because there is no external goal for it. It is not that the eye, the ego, looks out toward a goal for a certain purpose, but rather it is then the activity of the self, the activity of the self, that it is the important thing. We can put it this way, that one is in his act of self-creation. Who am I? What am I as a personality? What am I as an autonomous self? What am I in my freedom? I am in my act of self-creation. I don't first ask, what am I, and then follow that, but what I am in my act then of self-creation. Now let me comment just a moment on this. One can well take a position that denies that man's existence is rooted in a substance without falling into a position like that of Fichte. We can call Fichte's position here an activism. A-C-T-I-V-I-S-M, an activism. You have the idea of act, active, but it's an ism. It pushes us too far. It makes man's activity then the center of things, and you can then call it an activistic position. Now, we don't have to say that man's self is a substance in order to avoid an activism like that of Fichte. I'm going to take the position, as I have throughout this course, that man is in his covenant relatedness to God. Man is created. Man has been placed in the cosmos, standing before God. As we say, he stands before the face of God, or Coram Deo, C-O-R-A-M-D-E-O, Coram Deo. He stands then before the face of God. I'm going to take the position that man is in his covenant relatedness to God, to whom in his natural state he is in his free and joyful obedience to God, that man is in his free and joyful obedience to God. Or we can say that if man is apostate, then insofar as this apostasy shows in his life, then he is actively resisting God. But now, this view is perfectly compatible with the idea that man has a structure, that man is structured in his being, and I'm going to make a fair amount of this idea later on, that man is structured in his being. It need not at all imply, as we find in Fichte, this activism, that man is the creator of his own existence, that man creates his own existence. This idea of self-creation, as we have seen it crop up again and again, really stands has a very central position in the humanistic view. And here we find it coming out very, very strongly, the idea in Fichte, the idea of man as free, man as autonomous, man then as one who is in his own activity, the activity of creating himself. This is a position, Fichte's position, is one that usurps for man the place of the creator God. It's not necessary to do that in order to avoid an idea of substance. However, what we shall be doing as we go on was suggest then that man is not simply a substance. He is not one who is sufficient to himself, but that he is then in his relationship to God, but nevertheless, his existence is structured. Now, if Fichte, however, in his position, thought that by concentrating everything on man in his creative activity, he thought that he had found the answer to this problem of synthesis of which we were speaking. That was one of the problems that they had with Kant, that Kant had not really solved the problem of synthesis. The synthetic unity of things. How then can we draw everything together and so that it is in a unity? And Fichte thought that by referring everything to the self in his creative activity, that he could solve this problem. He tried to uncover the meaning of nature. Nature does not stand outside, is not something then which must be taken and joined together with the idea of self, but there was a fundamental, a basic unity already between the self and nature. And he tried to find the meaning of nature in this way, by what, from his point of view, could be called a transcendental deduction. Kant then had a transcendental deduction also. As we have seen, he tried to find the transcendental presuppositions for experience. Now, Fichte is trying to find the transcendental presuppositions for nature. What is it that lies behind nature and establishes the very ground of its possibility? What lies behind nature and establishes the very ground of its possibility? He argued in this way. He said, empirical knowledge is possible. The knowledge that we have through our experience, the knowledge of what we have and what we can call nature. If this were not possible, the ego, the I, would not be possible. But he said, it is certain that the I is possible. The ego is possible. And therefore, empirical knowledge is possible. In other words, an argument a fortiori here, that yes, indeed, if empirical knowledge is not possible, then the ego is not possible. But we know that the ego is possible, and therefore empirical knowledge must be possible. Again, there is the relating of everything to the ego, relating everything to the I, and trying to find then the ground of the meaning of everything, of the entire cosmos, in the ego. Now, it follows from an argument of this kind that the possibility of the world rests on the I. But Fichte says, the I, or the ego, rests in itself. The ego The self rests in itself. There is the center for Fichte, where he would find his ultimate point of reference, namely in the ego. The ego rests on itself, or it rests in itself. The reality of the I founds itself, because the I becomes an I through its own activity. You can't look outside the ego then. Why does it come into being? Why do I then become a self? How do I become free? Is it because of something outside? No. The ego founds itself. The I or the ego only becomes an I or an ego through its own activity. And so Fichte says that the I posits itself. This word posit is P-O-S-I-T. The I then posits itself. It establishes itself. It has the ground of its meaning, the very ground of its possibility within itself. It's easy to see then that for Fichte, the human ego really takes the place of God. If we say that all things relate to God and that God is the one who is sufficient to himself and that he is the one who is the source of meaning for everything, that he is the creator of all things and the sustainer of all things, you can see that these qualities then are invested by Fichte in the ego. So for Fichte, the creative I becomes the ground of the unity of freedom and nature. We're not going to just try to, I said there's a criticism of Kant that in him, nature and freedom remain too much simply separated from each other. They're separated from each other. And Fichte tries to draw them together, and he says the creative I then becomes the unity of freedom and nature. Now, according to Richard Kroner, I referred to him before, the heart of Kant's effort is that the true concentration point is found in the self positing itself. The true concentration point is found in the self positing itself. And it was this that was brought to clearer light by Fichte. Now here is the point for Fichte then, where things are brought together, as I said. Here is the point at which possibility and reality unite. Possibility and reality unite, where then they are identical. Let's look at that a moment. If one is, and then just surveys a whole group of possibilities, the question arises, am I then identical with any one of my possibilities? I can choose this, I can choose that, I can choose the other, and they stand outside of me, and we've found that that is makes a real problem within this humanistic view of freedom. Because if they simply stand outside, if they're a number of possibilities, am I not then fallen into a scheme where I'm dependent than on something outside of myself? So the idea has been to try to say that a possibility and the reality are identical. That these things just don't simply stand outside, but that the possibility and the reality at a particular point are identical. And Fichte that this is the point at which possibility and reality unite, where they are identical. Here there is no general law establishing the possibility of something, to which then reality is subsumed. There's no then, one might say later, abstract possibility. We didn't put it that quite way. There is no general law here establishing the possibility of something, to which then the reality is subsumed as particular contingent instances. We want to go back to our blackboard. We can think of it in this way, the law of which we're speaking as a horizontal line, and then several vertical lines. I have four of them here under that as the general law, and then the particular contingent instances. Let me then repeat what I said. According to Fichte, when we think of the creative ego as this concentration point, here there is no general law establishing the possibility of something, to which then the reality is subsumed as particular contingent instances. The self, then, is not an observer of certain possibilities outside of itself. We have referred to the observer problem from time to time. And of course, if the question for the humanistic idea of freedom, where am I identical with myself in my act? Where am I identical with myself in my act? If I'm observer of those things which then are determining my existence, those are outside of me. I stand outside of them looking on. I am an observer. But Fichte tried to get away from this. He said the self is not an observer of certain possibilities outside of itself, which it then can put into operation by means of an act that is essentially distinct from the principles. It's not then that we see certain principles or certain possibilities, and then these are established, and then we react by acting, by doing something, an act that is essentially distinct from the principles. Instead, our act and the principles are identical. That then there is a drawing together, there is a synthesis of these things. He said, the possibility and the reality of the self are one. Now, from his own point of view then, Fichte attempts to carry on the program of Leibniz, who attempted to make possibility and reality one. Now, in trying to make the ego the center, of course, Fichte was still concerned with this relationship to nature. Duyvaert puts it this way, and I quote from his new critique of volume 1, page 427. He says, and I quote, the dialectical process was described by Fichte as a transition from the free ego into its opposite, the non-ego, that limits the former, and as the synthetic reduction of this non-ego through the mutual determination and limitation of the two moments, colon, the limited ego and the limiting non-ego, both posited by and in the absolute ego. So there is indeed here an idea that in what is in nature, there is something That is limiting indeed for Fichte. But nevertheless, this limited ego and the limiting are both posited by and in the absolute ego. Again, we shall not go into this in any detail at this point, but again, simply to remind us that Fichte is attempting to draw together freedom and nature, the ego and the non-ego. Is this I, this ego then, which imparts meaning to experience? We can have experience that is true. But now we know that in
our experience, the one thing supersedes the other, that there is a change, there is an advance, let's say, in knowledge, the one thing. And so one asks oneself, if indeed there are various truths, but the one then is supplanted by the other, how are we able to gain an idea of truth in any absolute sense? In the interest of human freedom, we shall see this more clearly as we go on. There is the idea of what that one has then to be grasped by something. That one then has to, if he posits himself, he must posit himself in a certain fashion. There must be a certain content to that. But if we have this content, that content, and everything then simply relative, simply a contingent, how are we going to relate everything to this absolute ego? What will be the content for the ego in this act? Now he says, it's only as truths are related to the self that they are true in any absolute sense. All relative truth must be conditioned by the absolute. And this absolute truth, the way to absolute truth, is not found in the world, but through the self.
And that self, in the deeper sense of that which is the ground of both self and the world. And so it is only as we reflect on the self that we have an entree then to absolute truth. What Fichte will say is this, that it is the truth, the truth, final truth, absolute truth, resides only in the continuing, even the infinite activity of the self in its self-creation. But now, as we look at Fichte's position, a difficulty emerges that is typical of the idealistic tradition as a whole. There is a pervasive difficulty within this idealistic tradition. We note that the ideal of the freely operating personality is actually unreachable. You have to keep on going. Your idea, idea of absolute truth must be related to the ego, but the ego, the self, is always marching on, is always progressing. Well, and furthermore, the ideal of this freely creating personality is actually unreachable. It must be approached in an infinite approximation. And so, within the idea of free creating personality, there resides a difficulty. I believe that Hermann Dooyeweerd even calls it a contradiction. If one were able to reach the goal, that is, if we were able finally to come to the goal, he could no longer be free, because if you have a goal, it is it has been reached, that is a simple given. It is simply given. It's a datum. It's simply given. It's simply there. You've reached it. And if you have something that's simply there, that is part of nature. When you look at nature, you find that which is simply there as over against the self, which is constantly creating itself. The goal would be given, it would be part of nature. Now, one then constantly works toward the goal, but in a remarkable way, it's only as he continues to fall short of it that he is truly free. And so if we then must strive toward this goal, the final goal of free personality, then we are actually free only because we have not yet reached it. Such a goal is outside of the self as it is. And in a sense, then, it determines the self from outside. You have a problem here, then, that when you think of the self moving toward the goal still remains outside of the self. It is outside the self as it is, and therefore determines the self from outside. Now, in Fichte, we encounter for the first time, clearly for the first time, that the existing self and its activity are the consequence of what can be called a fall. That if the self is going to be free, it then is not the self in its ideal form. It is something then that is fallen from this. And so freedom in Fichte takes on the aspect of what has been called finite freedom. You have an ideal of freedom here, but yet as we are actually engaged in our self-creation, we are engaged in our self-creation in a way that can be called a finite freedom. We shall return to this idea of finite freedom during the next hour. But now, if we then reflect on what we have done by way of transition to the next subject, now I might remark this, that except for a few occasional references, Herman Dooyeweerd concludes his what he calls a diorama of the dialectical development of Western humanistic thought. He then concludes this with his description of the triumph of the personality ideal in opposition to the science ideal as it is found in the thought of Fichte. Here, as we observed, Dooyeweerd says, the personality ideal obtained its first pure expression in its opposition to the science ideal. It came here to radical expression. He then pretty well stops at this point. He refers in his works to thinkers, later thinkers such as Schelling and Hegel. Nevertheless, his systematic exposition of the course of modern philosophy under the domination of the motive of nature and freedom ends with a discussion of the philosophy of Fichte. Now, it is of interest to us to explore this history further. And there are several reasons for this. In the first place, the great idealists after Fichte, we Of course, you might say that Immanuel Kant is idealistic too, but even as Dorberg does, I am reserving the term idealism for those who tried then to overcome the Kantian dualism and to center everything more radically in the self. But now the great idealists after Fichte are thinkers of stature and influence. And they wrestled, even as Kant and Fichte did before them, with the problem of human freedom. And it is worthwhile then to take a look at what they were doing. Now, in the second place, in the thought of these later idealists, one comes across developments that bear on the theme of our course, namely the fate of freedom. At the very beginning, we talked about this, that we were going to talk about freedom, yes, the humanistic idea of freedom, but that within this humanistic idea of freedom itself, there is something that tends to make it turn into its opposite. There is what can be called a dialectic within it itself. There is an inner tendency within it that constantly brings it into crisis and that inclines to turn it into something else. And in these later idealists, one comes across themes that bear on what we have called the fate of freedom. Now, in the third place, developments within late idealism prepared the way for positions that have been taken in our own time. If we think of existentialism, for example. It is often said that Soren Kierkegaard is the father of existentialism. But if one looks at it more closely, he can see, as men have pointed out, that there are existentialistic moments in Hegel's thought, and you can go back, even as some have, to Schelling. And we have begun to uncover in Fichte, and possibly even in Kant himself, some foreshadowings, some adumbrations of these later developments. Well, this is very clear within what is called late idealism. Developments within late idealism, post-Kantian idealism, prepared the way for positions that have been taken in our own time, and one then can point to existential thinking as one of these. Now, we turn, therefore, to a brief exposition of this history. If we follow Dooyeweerd in the latter part of his, the second part of his first volume, down to Fichte, then we turn to a brief exposition of the history after Fichte. And the centerpiece of this presentation will be a description of the philosophy of Schelling. We shall refer to the philosopher Friedrich Schelling. We spell that capital S. C-H-E-L-L-I-N-G. His first name in the German is Friedrich. And we shall attempt to place his philosophy in perspective by showing that there were anticipations in Kant and in Fichte for the theme, the fate of freedom. And we shall find how these then come to expression in a clearer way in a more pervasive way in the thought of Friedrich Schelling, and then more particularly in what is called his second major period, what is called the quote-unquote later Schelling.